I'm Adam Riley, and this is Boston Public Radio. It's Friday, which means that we're going to be looking at the stories that came out of community newspapers and the alternative press this past week. On tap, we'll bid farewell to a Jamaica Plain legend, look at a congressional race that's been getting tangled up in family ties, and also examine why clammers in East Boston are taking on Massport. Here with me in Studio 3 are Sue O'Connell of Bay Windows and the South End News. Hey, Sue.
Hey, Adam.
John Roosh of the Jamaica Plain Gazette and Mission Hill Gazette. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And I thought I was going to see my old boss, Peter Kadzis of the Boston Phoenix, in the studio, but he is apparently joining us by phone. Are you from an undisclosed location, Peter, or can you tell us?
I'm in a studio in Maine.
It's mysterious. Okay. Well, I know each of you have come to the real or virtual table today with stories that you're eager to talk about, and you're actually veterans of this local news roundup, and I am not. So how does it usually work? Does Callie, when she's here, pick one of you to go first, or does one of you jump in?
We usually pick a story that's not on the list and see if she knows. No, we don't do that. You bring up the story you want to talk about, and we'll weigh in. How's that?
Well, that sounds good to me. Okay. Why don't we start with gentrification? Because we've got about three different gentrification-related stories that we all want to talk about. And, John, you have a couple that you guys have been covering. Would you like to tell us what's been going on in JP and Mission Hill?
Yeah, there's some certainly some major real estate developments coming to Jamaica Plain along South Huntington Avenue, and particularly in the heart of Hyde Square, which is the Latino community, or the Latin Quarter, as they have been marketing it for years. And these are high-end luxury developments of very large scale, in some cases up to 200 units, some condos, some apartments. And you know, there's a lot of discussion about this being pretty obvious gentrification coming to the neighborhood, whether that's considered good, bad, or sometimes both. One of the big ones right now is the former Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church site in Hyde Square. That was purchased by a nonprofit developer basically as an anti-gentrification deal so that they could build affordable housing there, which they did several years ago. But now the church itself is about to become condos selling for as much as $725,000. And another building on the site is about to become luxury condos as well. So there's some cries of betrayal at that site.
Let me ask you, as an outsider who knows Jamaica Plain a little bit but not particularly well, whenever I read about gentrification occurring there, and this was my reaction when there was the Whole Foods fight a couple months back, as an outsider, it seems to me like the gentrification ship has already sailed. Like Jamaica Plain, you know, is not nearly as affordable as it was a decade ago or two decades ago. And it kind of surprises me that there are people in JP who still think of it as, at least in part, you know, an ungentrified neighborhood. So, Peter, you actually live fairly close to the neighborhood, correct?
Yep. I'm within walking distance of the sites we're talking about.
So,
I've been living there for over 20 years.
So how much of JP, given that you have that local expertise, how much of it would you say still remains ungentrified, whatever that means, and how much has already been gussied up?
Well, you got to approach that two ways. First of all, rents in apartments that are definitely not gentrified are going for almost $1,000 a bedroom. Sales prices, you know, are going up. The only thing that keeps all of JP from, quote, being gentrified is the fact that many blue-collar families own their homes. But I have to tell you, on my street, on Peter Polly Road, in the last year, two longtime residents, one family had three generations, have lived in the house for three generations, are all selling their houses to cash in on higher prices, because JP is one of the only real estate markets in the state that has actually gone up in value. And, I don't know if that answers your question, but
The only thing that also keeps the South End from becoming Weston or Sherburn is that we have the most public housing developments of any neighborhood in the city. So if, you know, we like to boast about the economic diversity that's in the South End, but the reality is there's no middle. You know, there are a few people who bought, you know, to every neighborhood, some folks who bought brownstones and Beaufronts when back in 1974 for $75,000, and now they're worth over $1 million. But the vast majority of folks who are in the South End have bought their condo or are paying really high-end rents, either in these Beaufronts or in luxury housing like the Atelier. And at the same time, you've got the housing developments. So there's no middle part of the economic diversity. I'm neither, you know, pro or anti-gentrification. You know, there are benefits and negatives that come with it. And we're about to get our first Whole Foods in the South End.
Congratulations.
So thank you very much.
Great,
you know,
cheese section.
I love it. I love it. Just rich people, please try and pick the produce more quickly, please. But it just is what it is. And it speaks to the bigger issue of how do we keep a middle class and how do we keep blue-collar folk and hourly wage folk able to afford living in Boston?
Along those lines, when I read about the controversial development in Jamaica Plain that we've been talking about, it sounded to me like the developers hadn't actually watered down the affordable housing component of it that much. The figures that I have, and John, you can tell me if I'm right about this, is that originally the development was supposed to include, I think, 72% affordable housing. And now it's been taken down to 65%. Now, obviously, if they can drop it like that, they can drop it further. But 65% affordable housing doesn't sound that ominous. Again, as an outsider, is it ominous?
I mean, what they have managed to do on that site is unbelievable. That, you know, they built, I believe it's 81 units of affordable housing of various sorts. That ranges from home ownership to SROs. It's very significant, and it's long-term. It's going to be there for a long time. I think the concern is that what we're talking about is pitched as market rate, this luxury housing. But, in fact, it's going to drive the market, and it's going to drive prices up all the way around it. So that's where the concern comes in, and that's where the tension comes in. Gentrification is certainly already there in the neighborhood.
Affordable
housing. Go ahead, Peter. I'm sorry. He's pointing at me and saying, Peter, go ahead.
See, I think why JP is so important is that there is still an opportunity to achieve a degree of equilibrium. You know, it isn't totally gentrified. And I think that's why this, what would appear to an outsider to be, and frankly is, a relatively minor adjustment in the equation, nevertheless, you know, hits, you know, in Jamaica Plain.
Right. That makes sense. I know we have a lot of stuff to get to in the time that we've been allotted, and I don't want to spend too much more time on gentrification, but I do have to mention a story that I like just for the symbolism, which is Stephanie's on Newberry planning to open a new branch in the spot formerly occupied by the Quiet Man Pub in South Boston, which is one of these things that the symbolic value of the new business coming in and replacing that old business. For listeners who may not know, and I'm a Boston transplant, as some listeners may know, but what I remember about the Quiet Man Pub was the America, Love It or Leave It sign that was hung in the window, and it always struck me as sort of a bastion of old South Boston, for better or worse. Then you have Stephanie's on Newberry, this swanky restaurant coming in to cater to the increasingly swanky residents of Southie. Will either of you three, any of you three, I should say, shed a tear for the Quiet Man Pub as Stephanie's moves in?
No.
Why not?
No.
Well, I mean, you know, I shed a tear for the local watering hole aspect of it and the, you know, belly up to the bar and talk about local politics part of it. But, you know, the reality of what South Boston is and what it's becoming, where you can still, the biggest insult you can hurl at someone from a Southie native is that you are a liberal or you're progressive. Or yuppie, you know, where one place where the word still thrives. But, you know, it just represents, you know, business often follows what the market is driving. And the market driving right now in Southie is less of that and more of the Stephanies.
Peter, I think you said that you too will not mourn the Quiet Man.
I won't mourn it. Listen, when I was a kid starting out as a reporter, I covered the early years of the busing crisis and busing riots. And places like, you know, that pub were just cauldrons of hate. And I think we're better off without it. I mean, there are legitimate neighborhood joints around there like Amarines and others, but this is no loss. This is no loss.
Well, I'll say in my experience, yuppies are usually just as racist, but they're nicer about it and feel guilty about it. I more than anything moving because of due to financial pressure. That would be my stance.
Well, we've been promising to talk clams for the last, I think, 15 or 20 minutes. So it's time to talk clams. You guys ready?
Ready.
The story that came to our attention via Adam Gaffin and Universal Hub is this lawsuit that clammers in East Boston have brought against Massport and a jet refueling company for what basically amounts to this gargantuan, grotesque spill of gasoline into the waters around the airport. I want to read the description that the East Boston Times Free Press gave of what was apparently dumped due to this incident of stupidity that we'll talk about more in a minute. Here's what was dumped in the water that made the clams sick and destroyed the clammers' livelihood. 463 gallons of a fuel water mixture, 18 cubic yards of oily absorbents, and 4 cubic yards of oily sludge, all of which was quietly cleaned up by the company Clean Harbors and sent to their facility in Braintree, but done on the sly. And apparently, the clammers in East Boston have lost a lot of money as a result. I got to say, this does not make me want to eat seafood anywhere in East Boston. I've been to Belle Isle before and liked it. I may not go back. Are you three familiar with this story at all? I wasn't too. Okay.
You know, and
let's talk about what occasioned this spill, how it happened.
Well,
can you give us a description?
I can't give a description of the event, but I can tell you that as a Revere native and as a family in Winthrop and Belle Isle, and you know, that's it's amazing to me that there's an idea that this could be kept quiet. You know, that you've got all of the energy put into Deer Island and the great job that's been done cleaning water and making, you know, Revere Beach swimmable again and the great, you know, grades that the water quality has gotten. I mean, I can understand the urge to keep it quiet, but, you know, it's a major, you probably could have seen it happen. As you're going over the bridge between Winthrop and East Boston.
Here's how it happened, just to give listeners a sense. And this is my sense from reading the East Boston Times Free Press's coverage. There is apparently a device that people use when they're refueling jets that is supposed to cut off the refueling process if the person faints or falls asleep or leaves their position.
Or dies. The dead man switch.
The dead man switch. Thank you. And in this case, the individual who was refueling the plane in question, is it jamming the dead man? Is that the phrase they use? Which apparently just means disabling that safety so that they can go take a nap in their truck or talk to their buddies or whatever. And I guess it's common practice at Logan and probably other airports. But this guy who was refueling the plane didn't do business the way he was supposed to do it. And as a result, he didn't notice that the fuel was going the wrong way until nearly 500 gallons of it had come out. Which, like you said, it's shocking that you would think that you could clean up something of this magnitude and not have people know about it.
Just make them eat the clams.
Yeah.
that would be tough punishment, certainly. Isn't there a sort of a conventional wisdom, Sue, in East Boston? Peter and John, you might be able to talk about this as well. That holds that the neighborhood has kind of been kicked around for a long time by the Massport, by other institutions.
It absolutely isn't even a theory. You know, it's happened that when the tunnel or the bridge were there was an idea that the East Boston natives would be able to use the tunnel or the bridge without having to pay because they're part of Boston and why should they have to pay to go to Boston? And it's just continually been the kicking. The low end of the neighborhood pole, I think, when it comes to resources and power, and especially around Massport. You know, it's true that Massport certainly goes in and gives new windows and paves. You know, I was a recipient in Revere of getting new windows from Massport due to noise pollution. But it really, you know, when you get right down to it, it really is the low end of the pole.
Well, and these clamors in particular have a history there too. Well, you know, Massport wanted to kick them out altogether because they were, you know, what if Osama bin Laden was a clamor too or something? I mean, it was ridiculous.
The mind boggles.
Yeah, and it's so, you know, it's this whole history of a great a great local tradition, clamming, something very simple, you know, food on the table thing, and so, you know, here we are with these problems.
East Boston is without a doubt the most abused community in Boston. And it's interesting too, psychologically, psychically related to this is the whole issue of the gambling casino, which we're not talking about right now,
right,
I realize.
But
you know, people are trying to ram that right down their throat, too.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that because I was going to do the same and say it will be interesting to see how this, you know, the experience of decades or even centuries of second-class citizenship will inform that debate. I know I talked with one of the people, I've actually spoken with a couple of the people leading the anti-casino push in East Boston, and they are very much trying to say, here's yet another example of, you know, us getting Boston's trash or greater Boston's trash. You know, they're giving it to us because they, you know, they don't respect us the way they should.
And I think this used to be true, and I think it still is to some degree, that residents of East Boston think more of themselves as a greater Boston city and as part of the North Shore than they do as part of Boston. You know, and I know people who live in East Boston that don't go to the movies in Boston. They go to Revere. You know, and that whole northern look makes them just, you know, easy, prime for picking. You know, their pockets are going to get picked. Their political power isn't the same as it is in South Boston, obviously, or in the South End even.
But it's interesting that at least so far in the casino fight, busing, I know, was received pretty, there was violent, I shouldn't say violent pushback, aggressive pushback in East Boston to force busing. And I know there's been a lot of pushback against Massport. But there doesn't seem to be the sort of, and maybe it's, you know, maybe it's there and I just haven't noticed it, the same sort of widespread groundswell against the casino,
well,
at
you
least
live,
so far.
You live with the horse track and the dog track, Wonderland, which was also less than a mile away, I think, or 2 miles away from the East Boston border. I mean, the gambling, I grew up in between Wonderland and in between Suffolk Downs, and I didn't know that gambling was illegal until I was like 25.
Well, there's a flip side of the argument, too. I think a lot of people there want it. I mean, this is a great economic opportunity. And, you know, some of the real tension is how much of it is going to be in Boston, how much is going to be in Revere, who's going to get them, who's going to get what. So there is a flip side to that one.
Yeah. Peter, you guys have a story in the Phoenix this week about the 6th District congressional race and about not John Tierney's, well, to some extent it's about John Tierney's problematic family ties, but more about Richard Tessay's. Can you give us an overview of what David Bernstein, the reporter who wrote the piece, talks about and situated in the broader context of this race between Tierney and Tessay?
I'll try. It's complicated.
It is very
complicated.
This is,
it's essentially a story about the pot calling the kettle black. Just a bit of background. Most people know that Tierney's brother-in-law, his in-laws, are now convicted criminals involved in tax evasion and running illegal offshore gambling things. And his wife was implicated in this. The congressman in no way was involved. Now you have Tessay's family, who years ago were never convicted of anything, but through judges and different regulatory bodies, certainly called them sketchy and shady operators.
And there were some civil judgments went against them, correct?
Correct, yes. And the bottom line in all of this, and the candidate himself, it looks like did nothing illegal, but through a real estate transaction, helped hide $30,000 that creditors might have been after. Now,
his parents' assets, correct?
His parents' assets, yeah. Now, this was years and years ago, so why bring it up now? Well, because the Republicans attacking Tierney are saying, well, how can he not have known that his wife was mixed up with her criminal brothers.
Right.
Well, so the question now is, you know, how can the Republican candidate not know that his parents were deeply involved in very sketchy and shady business dealings? It's a story that, to my mind, has a lot of justice. It's like sort of, okay, you want to get down and roll in the mud here? Well, there's more than enough mud for us all to roll around in.
What kind of response did you – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, it's just – to me, this has nothing to do with the issues facing the United States right now.
And that was one criticism that some people made online, correct? Some commenters said, oh, why are you talking about this stuff? It's a distraction. Why aren't you talking about real issues?
Yes, people did say that online. We're more or less pointing out that the playing field is muddy all the way around.
Listen, this is a great Phoenix story. You know, this is exactly what the Phoenix, you know, does the best. And David, it's just amazing. And what I love most about it is that when you bring someone's family into it, I mean, this is sort of like the cardinal rule of politics. If you're going to attack someone's spouse, then your spouse is going to be up for attack.
Right.
And if you're going to put your spouse or your children out there, then the other candidate's spouse. And, the bulk of his campaigning is about this issue of the in-laws, you know, which are not even blood related if we want to go into, you know, the old-fashioned feudal way. This is his wife's in-laws. And so, you know, here you have this history, which, you know, I can't believe to say wasn't prepared for, and about his father's business dealings and a real estate deal, which I think all of us would have done if we weren't planning on running for Congress, and it's just fair game.
Do we know that Tesei wasn't prepared for it, though? Because I know he sat down for an interview with David Bernstein.
He was very forthcoming.
Yeah.
He was very forthcoming.
The impression I had reading David's story was that Tesei actually maybe had been prepared and knew what he was going to say and offered, you know, as David said, convincing answers to how much of this stuff happened. He didn't seem to be caught unawares the way, say, Elizabeth Warren caught unaware by the Native American story.
Good point. But at the same
time, he is not pulling a Romney.
Right. Well, that would be hard to do. that's a kind of art all of its own. But I wasn't
as convinced by this story. I mean, it was a great story, and I loved hearing another side of this thing. But, you know, there's the semi-shady but not illegal deal with your parents where you're helping them out. And then you got the illegal offshore gambling millions of dollars and one of the guys coming out of a courthouse saying the congressman's lying. That's really different. Now, you know, again, how much should we care? I don't know. But those are not equal things on a scale to me in terms of the hammer dropping on a candidate.
Well, let me ask you all for your prediction. Do you think that the revelations in the Phoenix about this part of Tesei's family history, do you think those revelations will resonate the way the conviction of Tierney's brother-in-laws did or not?
No.
I have two shaking heads in the studio. Peter, what do you think?
It's too complicated.
No, I don't think it'll resonate the same way, but I think it could make a difference in a tight race.
Yeah, and I think you just have to be careful when you present yourself as the Avenger, you know. And granted, Tesei is not responsible for whatever his parents did or did not do, and I don't begrudge him, as you so eloquently said, Adam, for doing something that was legal that might have helped his parents. But at the same time, you just have to be careful when you're wielding the big, you know, sword of justice.
And is there more there?
Right.
Who knows?
Since we have been talking about Phoenix-related matters for a moment, Peter, can you talk a little bit about the redesign and, I guess, relaunch of the Phoenix?
Sure. I mean, in late September, the Phoenix, the Boston Phoenix, is going to relaunch. It's going to be a magazine size, glossy paper. We're going to combine Stuff, our nightlife magazine, with the Boston Phoenix and premiere a weekly glossy magazine called The Phoenix. Stories like David Bernstein's piece on the 6th District race will be in there, but so too will be expanded dining coverage, some fashion coverage. I think it's a pretty exciting thing. one thing to understand about the Phoenix is that for years, our readers have thought of us as a magazine, but used us as a newspaper. And this seems to be the logical progression in moving forward. Listen, the bottom line is magazines economically are faring better than newsprint. Hmm.
Peter, how does this work with the WFNX.com? Do you see the website, the Phoenix website, as changing as well? And will FNX.com come under that umbrella?
Yes, and we're hoping to, you know, have an enhanced online streaming ready to go with the same ship date. But the web will be tying, you know, the new FNX, which is online. The web will be the sort of glue holding all this together. You know, there'll be a single portal you can go to online to get all of this news and music and style. So the answer is yes.
I have to ask, Peter, and this is a slightly awkward conversation for me to have with you as we broadcast live, since I used to
no,
work...
No, it's not. I can't fire you anymore.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Are you going to ask for a job?
But no, I'm not going to ask for
that'd
a job.
Awesome.
But
I am
going to ask, first off, what, if anything, that people are used to getting in the paper is not going to be available in the new publication?
I don't think much. We are going to have to trim some things, but we'll be adding some others. The honest answer here is Carly Carioli, who runs the Boston Phoenix and who will be running the Phoenix magazine, is, you know, wrestling mightily with Kristen Goodfriend, our design director, to put all this together. You used to work at the Phoenix.
Right.
We've been talking about this for a long time, but when we made the decision, we said, okay, now let's do this tomorrow. So it's still a work in progress. But I don't, listen, invariably something won't be there, but it won't be much.
And my other question for you as an interested alum is, where are you guys going to be based? Because I'm hearing all these rumors about different locations, one of which is actually pretty close to the WGBH studios. So any sense of what the ultimate destination for the PMCG is going to be?
Here's the latest update. And within the office, this is a real... The deal we were doing on for the old Reebok building appears to have fallen through for reasons that are too complicated to get into. Frankly, one of the spaces we're looking at is right in the GBH complex. There's also an outside chance, and it is outside, that we might be able to stay where we are.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's an outside chance. I think we're caught in a real estate market that is in turmoil. And the simple fact is, I don't know yet.
Yeah. Well, I think I said this to you the last time you and I chatted, but I'm blown away going into the Fenway area.
Oh, my gosh.
At how much it's changed in the last 3 years.
It's indescribable. I mean,
it's almost unrecognizable.
John, did you work at the Phoenix? Because I did too, so...
No, I wisely just freelanced.
Oh, good job.
I never had to forge in there, yeah.
But the difference on Brookline Avenue and that whole area, you know, I started working at the Phoenix, I think, in 1992. And, you know, it's as far as urban development goes, it's not that different a time span. And it is so remarkable.
It's incredible. There is one story that I really wanted to... Peter, actually, I just cut you off. I heard you preparing to speak.
No, that's
actually
fine.
I had one question just about the new thing.
Sure.
In terms of sort of the shift to more of a magazine type thing, is it still going to have editorials?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll still have editorials. You know, listen, for the content itself, I think for the NewsHound, the difference is going to be stronger graphics. It's going to be graphically more powerful and on a nicer stock of paper, which for business reasons we hope will appeal to advertisers. But there'll still be an editorial. I'll be ranting and raving about something every week.
Excellent.
So the story that I really want us to at least touch on quickly before we have to wrap up is this story about an obnoxious patron at the downtown restaurant, J.M. Curley, who took a seat at a table with a dining companion and tried to incentivize his waitress by putting a stack of $21 bills on the table and telling her that he was going to pull one away each time she made a mistake, saying, here's your tip, And each time you screw up, one of these dollars goes back in my pocket. I think the first, he did that after they didn't have the beer he wanted, correct? And then he tried to order an orange soda, was told that they didn't carry that, and pulled one of the ones off the stack, then pulled another one off because someone else served them their entrees. But the great part of this story, so that's the terrible part of the story, is that there are restaurant patrons like this out there, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
The great part of the story is that the managers decided to confront this guy to basically comp his meal and say, all right, you know, you guys don't need to pay us, but we'd like you to leave. And that after the managers confronted the patron, he became incredibly apologetic and embarrassed. He said, oh, you know, I work in the restaurant industry in New York, and I was just trying to have some fun. Oh, I'm terribly, terribly sorry. And then I think he, in fact, did end up tipping about $20 on a $55 tab. So let me ask, is there anyone, any one of you three, who disagrees with my fervent belief that this guy, I was about to get into something that's not broadcast safe, that this guy was a grade A jerk?
Yes. I agree. He should have been killed, actually, right there and there. He should have. That was it.
He too should eat East Boston clams.
Yes. Yeah,
I was going to say, I mean, my response would have just been, well, my first mistake will be to take that stack of money off the table.
Because leaving money on the table
is an idiotic thing to do.
Right, right. Okay, so we're all agreed on that.
Guy's a jerk.
All right, well, I think that is going to do it for us this week. I'm Adam Riley. I've been sitting in for Callie Crossley, and we've been going over the stories that went under the radar. I've been speaking with Peter Kadzis, executive editor of the Phoenix Media Communications Group. Peter, thanks for being here.
Terrific. Nice talking to you, Adam.
Likewise. We've also been joined by Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Sue, thank you.
Thank you.
And John Roosh, also the editor of the Mission Hill Gazette and Jamaica Plain Gazette. John, thank you for joining
us. Thank you, Adam.
Well, I see Edgar B. Herwick III has returned to the studio. Edgar, what are you going to be doing next?
Adam, I've got a quick question for you. Do you know what the 52nd largest city in Russia is?
52nd largest
city?
Yes,
not to be confused with the 51st.
This is going to take me a while.
It's Saki, a city of about 300,000 people on the Black Sea coast. Do you know why we should care?
I got to admit, I have no idea.
All right, well, I'll give you a hint. This song here that we're listening to, it's called Skating.
This song takes me back to being 8 years old when Charlie Brown's Christmas special was event television.
Aldi Trio from the Charlie Brown. Well, the reason why we should care about this city, it's the site of the 2014 Winter Olympics. And there is a local club right here in Boston that promises to be a really big part of the U.S. figure skating story come 2014. We're going to explain a little bit more about that in just a minute.
Sounds good. He's Edgar B. Herwick III. I am Adam Riley, and this is Boston Public Radio.